Welcome to CUV.com. I'm your host, David Medor, and we have a candidate running for state senate today, Senator Don Benton. We've invited every candidate running in every office who's going to be on the ballot in Clark County to participate in free-flowing interviews here. Don's been one of those candidates to respond. So welcome, Don. We welcome you here, and along with every candidate, we give you a lot of freedom. At the end, you can speak directly to the audience to wrap up whatever right. your final statement. In the meantime, I don't have any prepared questions. We're going to talk about what you want to talk about, like every candidate has the freedom to do so. Terrific. So you have a background. Let's start with your background. How long you've been serving your capacity?
I've served the citizens here in Clark County for 18 years, 2 years in the House of Representatives from 95 to 97.
State House of Representatives.
That's right. And then in 1996, I ran for the state Senate and was elected. And so I've served in the state Senate now for 16 years.
That's a long time. You've seen some changes.
It's even longer when you consider that 14 of it has been in the minority.
And by the minority.
And that makes it a lot longer.
Okay, when you say minority, not everybody knows what that means. What do you mean you've been?
Sure. Well, in the state Senate, there are 49 members. And so on the very first day in January when the Senate convenes, the Senate elects a majority leader. And that majority leader is elected by the 49 members. And if there are 25 or more from one party, then that party is the majority leader. So in the last 16 years, about 14 of those, 12, it's hard to remember, but most of clearly the overwhelming majority over 12 years of that time, there have been more Democrats in the state Senate than there have been Republicans. And so therefore, they elect a Democrat majority leader. And that puts me and my Republican colleagues in the minority. What that means is simply this. The agenda of the minority rarely even gets a hearing. So your ideas are crushed from the very beginning.
That must be very frustrating for whoever's in the minority.
Well, I've been in business, David, all of my life, since I was 17 years old when I started my first company. And so you get a good idea, you know, while you're getting ready for work in the morning, you get to work and you start implementing that idea. And hopefully by the end of the day, the idea is implemented and you're moving forward. You're a businessman. You understand how that goes. You're an inventor. You get a good idea and you go for it.
Get it done.
Yeah. It doesn't work that way in government. And that was the most frustrating thing for me when I went there. It's like, you got this great idea, but you can't move it forward because even if you're on a committee with eight people and seven of you think it's a great idea, you still can't move your great idea forward if the chairman of the committee will not allow it to have a hearing or will not schedule it for a vote. So that majority leader that's chosen on that first day appoints the committee chairmen or women that run the different committees. You know, we have got one on transportation, one on natural resources, one on taxation. And those chairmen unilaterally and dictatorially decide what bills will be given a hearing, scheduled for a hearing.
Let me ask.
So it's very controlling.
All right. So if you had a majority, if everybody thought like you, what would you do? What would be the top priority change that you would make that right now you can't make? What's the hottest item on the list that you can change if you could?
Overregulation, not only of businesses, but of school districts and cities, even our municipalities. We have over-regulated. We have so many laws for so many things. I don't think there's a citizen out there that can leave their house and in less than 10 minutes not commit some kind of a violation of law.
Okay,
whether
how about
it's federal, state,
a specific
or what.
Example? What's a very obvious example of the state over-regulating the counties or individuals?
The permits. Land use, water runoff, the Clean Water Act, all of these things have developed rules through the bureaucratic agencies that become impossible for local citizens to follow. You have to hire law firms and environmental firms and technical firms just to help you manage through the permitting process. I mean, one of the reasons we have such a tough time with unemployment in Clark County and in this state is that permits to build things take so long that companies go and build their businesses and their buildings somewhere else where they can get it. So one of the very first things I'd do is I'd pass a law that required agencies to issue permits in 90 days.
Okay.
That would get people back to work right away.
Okay. And right now we have a very powerful Department of Ecology. are making law, basically rules that end up being force of law. And I wonder, why isn't the legislature making law in these areas that are so substantial compared to the right. Department of Ecology? Let's say the Department of Ecology, for instance, they've got some very substantial things that are pretty much stopping most of the development in Clark County. Can the legislature overrule some of those things, or should they?
Absolutely, they can and should. What happens is, and we had a bill last year that would have dealt with this, but it was one of those bills that got crushed by the majority and never even had a hearing. And that is that the legislature should, by an up or down vote, approve all rulemaking by the agencies. Because typically what happens is this: we pass a law, the legislature passes a law. All the details for implementing that law, those are done through the rulemaking process at the agency. So if it's an environmental law or a land use law, the agency then goes through this rulemaking process and they make the rules to implement the law. Those are called WACs, the Washington Administrative Code. They're not laws passed by the legislature, but they're the rules passed by the bureaucratic agency to implement the law, so they have the force of law.
And they have the penalties of law. You
Absolutely.
Violate it, you're going to pay.
Absolutely.
Right?
That's exactly right. And so when the agencies, which are all, you know, run by whatever party is in power, because the governor, of course, appoints the heads of these agencies, mm-hmm. they make rules, and oftentimes those rules go quite a bit beyond what the law intended. And so this has been a pattern for some time. And so last year, one of my colleagues in the Senate, Senator Holmquist from Moses Lake, had a piece of legislation that would require the legislature to come back and review the rules that were implemented or proposed to be implemented, so the legislature could then either approve or not approve those rules.
So you would change the flow so that if the legislature passes a law, gets signed in a law by the governor,
right.
that would then be implemented, at least the attempt to implement it, by an agency.
Correct.
But before that can actually go into effect, you would change the process so that they would then, that agency would submit to the legislature
their proposed rules. That's right.
And then you would approve it or disapprove it or modify it.
Since the legislature is the one that passed the law, they're the ones that are in the best position to be able to tell whether or not the rules implemented to make the law go into effect are way beyond what the legislature wanted or not. So the legislators can say, well, wait a minute, that's not what we intended when we passed this law.
What's the argument against that, Don? Because there must be those, since you haven't been able to do that,
right.
what's the argument against that? Why are they thinking that just the government would grind to a halt? We wouldn't be able to actually get things implemented because it's all tied up in this argument going on all the time? Or why don't you have buy-in for that?
Right. Well, because power is very important to people that have it. And it would take away power from the agencies, and it would take away power from the governor's appointments to the people that run these agencies. And it would give the power back to the citizens and back to the people through the legislature.
But the way I see it, though, if you already have, let's say, a Democratic majority in the legislature that passed the law,
right.
and then you have the governor appointed, which is the same party in this case, agency, and then they come up with some proposal or some rules, and it goes back to that same Democratic majority in the legislature, how can that be a reduction in power?
Well, because they have unilateral authority at the rulemaking stage.
Unchecked.
Yeah, unchecked by the legislature or the courts or anybody else. I mean, it's really the executive branch. And we're talking about three branches of government here. So the executive branch essentially would be giving up some of its authority to make rules and give that back to the legislature or back to the citizens.
Okay.
And that's pretty much the main reason why they don't want to do it, is that the executive, the governor's office, the governor sees that as an assault on their authority to have to share that with the legislature.
Even at this point, it would be a challenge. Maybe, maybe not. The other party will be change this time. We have a new change
of
leadership.
Well, we got a chance to get in the majority.
But let's suppose that doesn't happen. I've heard someone say that the solution to stormwater control in Clark County is a new governor. Is that true, or is that an exaggeration?
No, I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think if we have a new governor, if Rob McKenna is elected governor, he has the opportunity to appoint almost 2,600 appointees.
Really?
That's
2,600.
That's a lot of authority.
That's a lot of.
Well, every member of the Utilities and Transportation Committee, Commission, rather. Every community college trustee in Washington State at every district is appointed by the governor.
Can they just switch them midterm?
Board of Regents, the University of Washington. Well, I'll give you an example. Those are six-year terms. So if you appoint a member to the Board of Regents of the University of Washington, mm-hmm. and the Senate confirms that appointment will run for 6 years, even though the governor's term may only run for four. Once the appointment has been confirmed by the Senate, then the appointment runs until the appointment runs out. So if it's a four-year term or a six-year term, doesn't matter who the governor is once confirmation occurs. However, if the governor appoints someone to a position and their confirmation has not been confirmed by the Senate, that vote has not occurred, then what happens when a new governor is elected, the Senate Majority Leader asks the governor to return all appointments that haven't been confirmed to the governor's office. And by courtesy, the Senate typically sends all appointments back to the governor's office that have not been confirmed. So the new governor then has an opportunity to implement their will.
So the change of the guard can be a very substantial change, not only at the state level, but all these other intermediate and local levels.
Throughout every agency, the Water Quality Control Board, the Environmental Board, all of them are appointed by the governor.
So that atmosphere, that environment can change dramatically just simply with whoever is at the helm there at the governor. Let's move on to the next question, Don.
Okay.
We have a jobs crisis. You know that we have a jobs crisis here in Clark County. Not only across America, people think that we're a victim of circumstances. In reality, there's a lot of discretionary environmental changes here, whether or not we're environmentally smart or keep running up the bills for things borrowing from the future. The question is, specifically, what can you, as a state senator, do to address our jobs crisis, to fix our jobs crisis? Mm-hmm. What's the number one thing you can do? So you already said stop the overregulation.
Okay, there are five things that I would do if we can get control of the Senate this year, majority control of the Senate, we could change the law in five areas immediately. It would create immediate job opportunities.
And those areas are?
Okay, number one, double the B&O tax credit for new businesses and even existing businesses for hiring.
Okay.
Just double the B&O tax credit.
Okay, so people know what B&O tax is.
Business and occupation tax. It's a very regressive tax. In Washington State, we're one of only two states in America that use this kind of a tax system. Mm-hmm. Businesses pay taxes on their gross revenues.
Whether or not they make a profit.
So it doesn't matter if the company makes a profit or not. You could be losing money and still have to pay. Mm-hmm. If you sell $500,000 worth of goods, but it costs you $600,000 worth of inventory to make those goods, you've lost $100,000. You still pay taxes on $500,000 worth of sales. Mm-hmm. So it's your gross receipts, regardless of how much money you make, how much it costs you to make that money. Whatever comes in the door in terms of gross revenue is what you're taxed on in this state.
Okay.
So very regressive. So what we do is we would create a tax credit for every new job every new person that you hire, you give a credit towards your business and occupation tax.
Okay.
In other words, you reduce the tax burden in return for creating a job. That's one.
Yeah.
Number two.
Let me just mention that because we pay at U.S. Digital, we pay
our share
of B&O taxes.
I do in my business as well.
Yeah. Well, we all do. So you're not talking about the state giving money to businesses. You're talking about businesses giving money to the state and reducing the amount that they give to the state. Proportional to the number of new employees that they hire.
Absolutely.
Okay, what's next?
Absolutely. Number two, renewable energy. A lot of businesses, for example, the aluminum industry, it's been devastated in this state. We had a huge employment in the aluminum industry.
Right here in Clark County.
On Columbia River, Alcoa, and then, of course, in Longview, there was a big Reynolds plant. They were very good paying jobs. It was hard work. The people that did them were really, you know, tough
heavy
folks,
industry.
You know, heavy industry. But they depended on low energy costs because of hydro and the dams. We've been able to provide traditionally low energy costs.
Sure. Those power lines that run from Bonneville Dam over here to West Vancouver, wasn't that pretty much the electrical conduit for the Alcoa plant?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we have a lot of other industries give you an example, SEH America. They make silicon. They grow silicon there. They actually produce it. Producing silicon takes a tremendous amount of electrical power. Now, the reason we have SEH America here is because, A, we have cheap power, or have had, okay, and B, because we passed, when I was first elected to the legislature, a manufacturing sales tax exemption that allows you to be exempt from paying sales tax on manufacturing equipment. Those machines that grow that silicon cost over $5 million a piece. And at the time, SEH America was looking to expand their plant, and they were looking in Oregon, and they were looking here at their existing plant to bring in 30 new machines at $5 million apiece. Well, they were going to do it in Oregon because they weren't going to have to pay a sales tax on it. When we pushed through the manufacturing sales tax exemption in 1995, that was when SEH America decided to build the expansion here instead of in Oregon. And that brought over 200 new jobs to Clark County.
New industry. And they, and each of those jobs, that business helps to ripple through to create other jobs.
Well, look
as
at all the sandwich shops and all the gas stations and all the laundry facilities that have to be to take care of 200 or 300 or 1,000 new workers. So absolutely, it spreads to everybody when you have a plant like that that chooses here instead of there. But so, with the initiative, now I believe it was 937, I hope I'm right on the number, but we passed an initiative that required all power that's generated in this state to, over time, a certain percentage this year, a bigger percentage next year, the percentage grows, to be what's called renewable energy. It's an environmental green thrust on energy generation. Now, the problem with that is it didn't include hydro. So we rely on our rivers and our dams for a lot of our electricity. It's certainly renewable because mostly it's rain that comes out of the sky or snow that melts that drives these dams and these turbos. It's certainly renewable energy.
Sure.
But we don't recognize, like many other states do, that dams or hydro is a renewable resource.
Yes, and I think that was I-960, I think, was the but I could be wrong, too.
The legislature,
that's been, what, how many years ago now?
It's only been about 5 years.
Okay, but 5 years, and there's been a lot of discussion about this. The legislators all know about that problem.
Of course
that
they do.
Hydro, I mean, water flowing over a dam that's already created, that's not burning any energy, that doesn't add any carbon dioxide, that doesn't pollute in any respect, gives essentially free power, and yes, you got to make sure you have a way for the fish ladders to work, and so that you don't harm the environment. But this is for us to be able to say that we're going to move away from that to wind. Wind is for generation of power. You look for consistency for so you can. But wind is all over the road.
Right,
it's not consistent. It blows or it doesn't blow, and you got to be able to always regulate that. And so why hasn't the legislature fixed that? Can't they fix that?
Certainly they can fix that, and they should fix it, because we're losing good jobs because we cannot compete anymore
with the
power. What's
the argument for not including the hydropower in that definition?
Well, I have a few theories about this, and you'd have to talk to the folks that are against it to find out exactly what their problem is. But I believe, A, there's a move in the legislature and by the environmental groups that are out there, some quite radical, to completely eradicate the dams on the river. And so I think they're afraid that if we included hydro as a renewable resource, it would create yet another roadblock to their attempt to remove all of the dams. I believe that's one.
Seems hard. I mean, my brain kind of short circuits on some of this stuff because I look and I think, even what alternatives are there? You got wind, and there's all this now that they're discovering that it's killing birds, endangered species birds, and so all of these things, they have some negative consequences that it's unavoidable. You have solar. Solar sounds really good, but in the Northwest, that doesn't work so well.
No,
we have not so many
not a lot
days
of sun.
Here. Yeah. So what are you going to use? You have to actually pick a choice that is viable, and we have that. And for us to abandon that, it seems absurd. But
unfortunately, again, it goes back to the majority situation, okay, where you've got the House and the Senate and the majorities. You know, we have a lot of influence from the Seattle marketplace, okay? Mm-hmm. And frankly, the fact of the matter is the radical environmentalists have a lot of sway okay, yeah. with Democrat legislators from populous and sure. dense areas like Seattle. And that's, I'm sure, one of the reasons why we can't make this change. Oh. That change should be made right away.
So the first one is to stop the overregulation, right?
Stop overregulation.
Well, actually, the B&O tax credit for people for hiring new employees.
Right.
The second one is to include hydropower in the definition of,
that's right.
of our energy, to meet our energy needs. Mm-hmm. What's the third one, Don?
Well, I mentioned it when we first started. It would be one of the very first things I did if I had a magic wand, and mm-hmm. that would be to require all permits to be issued in 90 days.
Okay.
To allow...
And what happens if they don't include, if they don't hit that window?
Then the permit is granted.
Okay,
so there's certainty. So companies know I can get online and get manufacturing and going. I have a couple of friends that wanted to open a barbecue joint. They rented a place that used to be a blimpy submarine shop right here in Vancouver. They were going to be open in June. But because of sign regulations, because their smoker had to be permitted by the Environmental Protection Agency, I didn't know that, but now I do. You have to get a permit from the federal government to open a restaurant now if it's got a smoker. They had to change the size of the bathroom because the regulations and permits had changed since it had been a blimpy sandwich shop. Mm. So even though it's still, they had to put in a $10,000 fire hood, even though they're not cooking, they're only smoking. Mm. So instead of opening in June and hiring three or four people to get their little sandwich shop up and going, they ended up not getting open until November at an additional cost of 20 some odd thousand dollars than what they had planned. That kind of uncertainty, that kind of additional cost will keep small businesses from opening.
Yeah.
There's no question about it. And so we've got to be able to get those permits quickly and in an efficient manner so businesses can get open and get up and running and start hiring people.
Absolutely. Whatever
Chuck's
we can
Produce
do.
Is another great example.
Yep.
They wanted a $400,000 traffic impact
fee. They want $940,000.
Okay. And that included the permit fee, I think. The building permit fee and the traffic impact were almost a total of $1 million.
I think they finally ended up at around $440,000 is the permit cost for them now.
Just and so that's before they before even they, turn one shovel of dirt to build the place. Okay. So what kind of money do you, and by the way, have you tried to borrow money lately? Okay, you're not you're not going to borrow money to start a company to open a business for less than 10 or 12% on the market today. So who's going to borrow $1 million to get the permits in order to build a
business? That's your startup
crazy.
Capital.
Number four.
Well, before you do that, this 90-day requirement, when people go to get a permit, they go to the city, they go to the county. Does
Correct.
It require those entities to grant that permit within that time?
Yes,
or is this other agencies?
It's
just simply, basically, at the beginning of whatever
agency.
Level it is, you've got to approve it within 90 days.
That's right. Approve it or deny it.
Okay.
I mean, you don't have to approve every permit, certainly if it's not qualified or doesn't.
Okay. At least you've got
to
act on it.
But you have to make
effective.
A decision, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. You have to give business people certainty.
Sure.
Otherwise, they're going to go to where they can find certainty.
Yeah, okay. And I see that. There's two ways to get that permit streamlined through. One is you have staff that is there to say, I'm here to serve you. I'm here to make you successful. I'm here to make your life easy. And nobody needs to force me to do that.
That's
I'm here to make this world a better place. The other way is, we got a bureaucracy and we just got to do it. And hopefully you won't have to force that. Hopefully we make a change at these local levels to fix that. What's your next...
Every level has to understand that we've got to get our neighbors back to work.
Yeah.
And the sooner we get our neighbors back to work, the better everything's going to be.
Okay.
Because the more people that are paying taxes, the more revenue coming into the government, the schools won't suffer, the Department of Licensing won't suffer. Everyone wins when we get our neighbors back to work.
Okay.
And so these are the things I think that will get people back to work.
Did you cover five of them?
Quickly. I haven't yet. There's two left.
Okay.
Moratorium on rulemaking. We talked about this rulemaking earlier.
Mm-hmm.
There are enough rules. There are enough laws. We've got thousands of them. What we need to do, and the governor agreed with this last year, temporary moratorium on all agency rulemaking. No more rules. Let's make sure that we know what the rules are now. Let's deal with the rules that we have now. Let's stop making new rules as we go along, changing rules in the middle. Like I told you on the sandwich shop, the bathroom wasn't big enough now because the rules have changed since it was a sandwich shop. So they need a bigger bathroom.
Mm-hmm.
Let's stop changing the rules in the middle of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Moratorium on all rulemaking.
Okay. Well, we are employing many rulemakers. So if you're going to stop the rulemaking, doesn't that mean that some of those people are going to no longer be employed as rulemakers?
There would probably be a reduction in some government employees in the rulemaking department, yes.
Okay.
But I don't think it pales in comparison to the number of jobs that would be created by lowering the rules and granting certainty.
Sure. And the stat, if it's accurate, is that it takes 8 private jobs to support 1 public job. So if you can basically save 1 public job, you actually saved 8 private jobs.
Created 8 new jobs.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. And the last one would be outlaw unfunded mandates. You know, the legislature is always good at passing rules on people. Oh, that's a great idea. Let's make that a law. Or, oh, well, this is a great idea. Not realizing that when you make a state law, whether it's on a business, whether it affects a business, or whether it affects the city of Vancouver or the Evergreen School District, we pass laws that cost people money. The Evergreen School District has to go out and comply. That costs them money to comply with that. We don't give them the money to comply. We just say you have to comply. So they have to then go find the money in their own budget to comply with this new rule or this new law. So unfunded mandates.
Unfunded mandate says the state says you got to do something new, and here's no money to do it. It's going to cost you.
You got to do it, though.
So if they if there is a new requirement to do something, then there has to be some compensation, some funding to make it happen.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
You can't make other agencies do things unless you're going to tell them where they're going to find the money to be able to do it.
Okay.
It's one thing to be able to say, you got to do this, but when they can't do it, or they've got to take away a service that they're providing to the public in order to qualify for this, this crushes those agencies. That makes it impossible for them to be able to do a permit in 90 days if they've got to divert employees from the permit department to go comply with this unfunded mandate that comes down from the state. If we did those 5 things, we would have people back working within 90 days in this state. We would, there would be jobs, there would be businesses building and businesses opening. And that's the approach we need to take. We need to focus on jobs like a laser beam. That has got to be, this last year, I was so disappointed with the legislature. You said, is it frustrating? Yes, it's very frustrating as a business owner. When we went up to the legislature knowing that we're in a financial crisis in this state. We weren't sure how many teachers we might have to lay off. We weren't sure if we were going to have to lay off police and firefighters. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we get up to the legislature and I'm there ready to dig in right away. We even went early. The governor called us in a special session in November, you remember. Mm-hmm. And we thought, okay, we're going to deal with this. It's going to be serious. And instead, the legislature spent the first 5 weeks dealing with
redefining marriage.
Yeah, the same-sex marriage. It's like, where's the priority?
We're running out of time here, Don. Let me see. All of the agenda that you have right now sounds like it's basically universal across the state, and because we're not the only county that's suffering the lack of jobs here.
Absolutely.
Our economy is going south, and it's kind of stagnating. If we're recovering, it's far too slow. We need help.
Very slow.
But there's also each county has its own specific, your agendas and problems. And in this case, the biggest one by a factor of hundreds of times for our area is this CRC light rail tolling project. We have on our ballot in Clark County, actually 3 Proposition 1s. How in the world there should be hopefully there's not going to be confusion there. But if the voters say no to Proposition 1, the new tax to fund the operation and maintenance of light rail and bus rapid transit, if they say no, many of the local representatives are saying, well, that really, we'll find another way. Is that right?
That's
I asked
Larry
Moeller
last night,
if people say no, are you going to respect that? Does that mean no? Or does it mean yes another way? How do you feel? I mean, do you have a say-so on this?
You bet I do. I have been a strong proponent of the initiative process and referendum process in this state. And the reason for that is this. I put my trust in the citizens of this state, in the citizens of this community. They know what's going on. They're paying attention. When they go in and vote, they know what they're doing. And if they vote no, they mean no. The legislature doesn't know better. Just because I was elected to the Senate doesn't make me the most brilliant person in Clark County. That's ridiculous. I'm a regular citizen just like you or anybody else. I'm there to represent the will of the people, not to circumvent or override the will of the people. I'm the people's representative. So if the people vote no, What part of no don't you understand?
Well,
I'm there to implement. Now, I've been fighting it, of course, all along because I think it's the biggest boondoggle and waste of taxpayers' money I've seen in my entire career. We've wasted over $160 million. We have nothing to show for it. And if we build a huge bridge across the river and there's still only three lanes that meet the bridge on either side, even with light rail, will it do anything for congestion? And the answer is no. Even the experts tell you that by the time they're finished building it, traffic will be backed up to Ridgefield.
Yeah.
And the studies also indicate that light rail will do nothing to solve any congestion problems. Yes. 97% of light rail users are people that were already using public transportation before. They just went from the bus to the train. How does that solve congestion?
It doesn't. There are arguments on both sides of this thing. There's advantages and disadvantages.
The tolling is the one that scares me.
If
you're lucky enough to have a job, but it's in Oregon, you're now going to have to pay an extra $100, $120, $150 a week just to be able to get back and forth to work.
Yeah.
This is the wrong time for that kind of
a burden. The actual specific numbers there is $8.28 round trip, $4.14 each way.
Now, I'm just curious, or six if you're working 6 days a week.
And that's for cars. It actually goes up substantially. If you look at the Tacoma Narrows, they actually have a website that shows how much it costs for how many axles. And the it's $12 for a diesel truck to go across the Tacoma Narrows.
Think of the employers in here and getting our stuff to the port. If you're shipping out of the port of Portland, how much more is it going to cost you to get your stuff across that river?
Yeah, that's our lifeblood. I'm curious. So with you, no means no.
Absolutely.
And I wonder, we have people like Tim Leavitt, and we have people like Jim Mueller, who see it in their own mind that you've elected us to make the tough decisions. And, you know, we really need to, there's things you don't understand. And so we're just, if you say no to that, we've already decided it's going to be yes anyway. How do you talk with them? How do you fix that?
It's very unfortunate.
You
have to replace people that think like that. I mean, honestly, we are a representative republic, okay? And what that means is you're supposed to represent the people.
So a representer.
If the overwhelming majority of the people in your district are against something, how in the world can you be for it? You're supposed to be representing them in the legislature. That's what I've always tried to do, and that's why I really respect the initiative process. Mm-hmm. And every time somebody tries to change it, I'm there to say, hey, wait a minute. In our Constitution, we have the initiative process, and it's in there for a reason, and I'm going to fight to protect it because the citizens, they have the last say. After all, it is the government of the people.
Right? By the people and for the people. And I think you're right in that somehow some of these representatives, if you call them representatives, they're elected officials, see it as of the bureaucracy, by the bureaucracy, for the bureaucracy, and I think who are they representing. And it is up to us to participate and decide, is that important enough for us to be able to take that person and replace them with somebody else who will actually represent citizens rather than a bureaucracy. We're pretty much out of time, so let me do, if you have anything, you can have a few minutes here to just simply speak directly to the voters with a closing statement. So you got it, Don.
Excellent. Well, listen, first of all, thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate being here, and I appreciate an opportunity to talk to the voters of Clark County directly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's been an honor and a privilege to represent you in the state Senate and the state legislature for all these years. I hope that you've come to trust me and know what I stand for. During elections, there's always lots of lies and innuendos and misrepresentations that fly. My opponent proved in the primary that he's willing to say and do anything to beat me. If you have a question, a concern, if you want a clarification on any claim that is made about me, please call me directly. My number, my office right here in Vancouver is 574-7369. Call me directly. People are surprised I actually answer the phone, and I talk to citizens every day. And so I'm very accessible. So if you have any concerns, call me. What I really would like to do is, whether you're an independent, a Republican, or a Democrat, or you don't identify with any of those labels, I want to ask for your vote this year. This is a very critical election. We would certainly like to get to a majority situation in the state Senate so that we can implement some of the ideas that I've talked about here today. We desperately need to get my neighbors and you back to work. And I think that some of these things that we've discussed will get our folks working again. And if we can get our folks working again, we don't have to raise taxes. There'll be more revenue. And that's really what I'm focused on. So please, I'd appreciate your vote. If you have any questions for me, call me. I'm very accessible. My website is senatordonbenton.com. That's www.senatordonbenton.com. You can read about all my positions there. Write me an email. Certainly call me. Over the next few weeks, I'm going to be out and about on the street corners and doing meet and greets and knocking on your doors, and I look forward to meeting you. Thank you very much.
Very good. I guess that wraps it, Don. Thank you, sir.
Thanks for coming in.
You bet.